Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels. We thank you so much. And again, as always, we encourage you to visit our website, WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Good morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York. Welcome you to this January 22nd edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network and in collaboration, conjunction with YCRadio.org. Well, we're just a few days beyond the one-year inauguration of that, well, I don't know how to describe this, whatever, that's in the White House, but nonetheless, that's happening. Government shutdown is happening. There has never been such disarray, such chaos in recent history. But, you know, be that as it may, we will survive. Anyway, first and foremost, we want to encourage you to continue to encourage our listeners to become WBAI Budders. Keep the faith, keep the faith. Let's build a strong base of listener supporters. Let's work through the difficulties, the crises, hang with the situation as we, you know, continue to try to keep WBAI not only alive, but have it to thrive and strengthen it moving forward. So become a WBAI buddy. You can do that by simply going to give to WBAI.org. And for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member of WBAI. I am a WBAI buddy. I constantly say I don't ask people to go where I'm not prepared to go, and I'm prepared to. I am a WBAI buddy. So keep the faith. Let's keep rocking and rolling and moving along here on Resistance Radio. Well, today we have two books we're going to take a look at. First of all, coming up shortly, Dr. Ana Lucia Araujo, and I'm going to see whether I pronounced that correctly, who is a professor of history at Howard University, has a new book called Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade. And then Asher Bandeli, who is a longtime friend, actually, somebody I've known for many, many years, brilliant, brilliant woman, organizer, tremendous literary skills and artistic skills with the Drug Policy Alliance, will be on to talk about When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir, which was done along with Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then I'm going to get up on the soapbox today, and you need to tune in because I intend to throw down on Negroes. That's right, Negroes who harm the race, because I've been seeing some things that I think are very, very detrimental. Some of it will be loving and kind. Other aspects of it will not be intended to be so. So anyway, that's going to be for our show for today. Then you'll get a chance to call in to react, particularly to these Negroes who harm the race. But first up, we want to go immediately to our guest standing online, Dr. Ana Lucia Araujo. I may be pronouncing that wrong. She will soon correct me. Professor, welcome to Vantage Point. Hello.
Doc, we're still trying to raise Dr. Araujo in just a moment. Hopefully we'll have her.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I thought we had her connected in. Anytime there's something about reparations, any new volumes about reparations, we're eager to hear about them. And by the way, if you want to learn, because we did a major, major piece, and we try to keep our WBAI audience up to date on the work that we're doing around reparations. And we recently did a major, by we, I mean the National African American Reparations Commission, National African American Reparations Commission, which is convened and facilitated by the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, recently had a phenomenal reparations gathering in New Orleans. And you can go to the website, ibw21.org, that's ibw21.org, and you can actually read the communique. But Don Rojas, who is a former general manager at WBAI, actually, is actually the one who put this together, and it's really, really very well done. So we hope that you can go and take a look at it. It has images and photos of the event that are there, and this gives you a real sense of it was really phenomenal in terms of the turnout, the engagement, and the participation of the persons who came to New Orleans over a 2.5-day period. It was really, really good. So we hope that you'll have a chance to go and look at that. And of course, you recall that we really had a phenomenal event too in New York, which really sort of started things off. And that was a national international summit on reparations, which we held in, I think it was 2015 actually. And WBAI really supported that very strongly. We had people come from over 22 nations from around the world for that event. And we also had a hearing and town hall meeting in Atlanta, which was equally successful. A lot of work being done around H.R. 40, the reparations study bill that has now been converted into a bill to actually look at reparations proposals. And by the way, that continues even beyond the tenure of Congressman John Conyers. I think I want to take a brief pause here, because I think we may have not have the right number for our guest, and I'm going to try to get that number, because she is no doubt standing by. There are two numbers here, and I'm just actually noticing the email, and it seems that the number that I gave is not the right number. So I'm getting ready to try to connect on that. So Michael, our chief announcer, can we just take a brief pause?
Thank you.
And we return to Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Okay, thank you again, Michael G. Haskins, our chief announcer at WBI. My bad, I had not really read closely. I got so many things on my brain, the communications back, so I was really looking at the wrong phone number. But now we have Professor Ana Lucia Araujo. She will have correct that for me, Professor. I know I must have mangled it, then please forgive me for doing so.
Yes, I am here. Thank you for having me.
Pronounce your last name for me. I want to make sure I'm saying it correctly.
Araujo.
Araujo.
Exactly. Perfect.
Araujo. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And you're the director of undergraduate programs at Howard University.
Yes, indeed. I am professor of history in the Department of History at Howard University. I have been graduate director, but now I am undergraduate director.
Oh, undergraduate director. Okay, all right.
Yes.
I mispronounced that. Well, anyway, you have this new book out for on slavery and the slave trade, and I'm just interested. Tell us a bit about your background. Why is it that you decided to undertake this topic?
Let me tell you, I've been working on the history of slavery and the Atlantic slave trade for now more than 15 years. And indeed, I am Brazilian, and this is why my last name is weird for many of the folks who are listening us. Then my country, indeed, Brazil, is the country that imported the largest number of enslaved Africans during the period of the Atlantic slave trade. Then Brazilian society was shaped by the Atlantic slave trade. And I have been studying these issues then for more than 15 years, but especially how slavery is memorialized in the public space through monuments, through museums, through memorials, and how slavery is also very often concealed in the public space. And during this work, I noticed that there were sometimes discussions about then financial and material reparations for slavery, but all the time these discussions were very, then generated a lot of controversy, whereas many then social actors, governments, and so on have been accepting the idea that we should memorialize slavery in the public space. There was a lot of resistance any time that the issue of financial reparations and material reparations were brought to light. And then I decided to write this book because I think that this is a conversation that we need to have, then especially in this society such as the United States and Brazil, where slavery was societies that were built on the back of the slaves at the end of the day.
Well, let's talk specifically about Brazil, which is a very fascinating country because it has the largest African population outside of Africa, at least in this hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And so how is reparations treated in Brazil? Is there any effort for there to be any compensation for slavery? Are there reparations commissioned? And you should be aware that one of the things that we do, and I do at the Institute of the Black World 21st mm-hmm. Century, we work very closely with the CARICOM Reparations Commission, and we have a National African American Reparations Commission here in the United States. And we've been having some discussions about Brazil, mm-hmm. actually. So talk to us mm-hmm. about Brazil. What's happening there in terms of the reparations movement?
That if I say this from the today's perspective, the most important initiative that we have in Brazil right now regarding reparations is a national truth commission about slavery. This is a commission that is inspired by other commissions that existed in Peru, that one that existed in Brazil to investigate the crimes of the military dictatorship that existed in Brazil since between 1964 and 1985, similar also perhaps to what he had in South Africa. Then this is the National Bar Association in Brazil. I have contact with these lawyers who are leading these initiatives. Then they are black lawyers, most of them. And this is a commission that then gathering activists, lawyers, historians, that the goal is to study slavery. And eventually we know that the idea is to perhaps formulate demands of financial and material reparations. There were demands of financial and material reparations in Brazil since the 1990s. Before that is different from the United States, because before that, because of the dictatorship, it prevented the black movements in Brazil to have this kind of action. But most of the focus over the last years has been the issue of symbolic reparations. Through affirmative action, for example. Also, there is a discussion in Brazil regarding the land redistribution to the Brazilian black populations that are called the remnants of the communities of runaway slaves. And though many of these communities have been recognized since the passing of the Constitution of 1988, most of these communities didn't get the titles of these lands yet. Then this is the general picture in Brazil. The fight is in progress.
Mm. So one of the things that seems to me you're saying is that there are discussions about symbolic reparations, museums or ceremonies and so forth. But that the
exactly.
difficulty is when it comes down to material and financial reparations is where the resistance comes in.
Exactly. Even the government that has been ruling Brazil, the party that has been ruling Brazil over the last 13 years, that now it's a different government that is in place. But even the Workers' Party that led a lot of measures to empower Brazilian black populations during the time it was ruling the country. When they were asked about financial reparations, and this is in the book on Chapter 5, the minister at the time, she just declared that what they were doing was enough and that there were no perspective of financial reparations. And there is a lot of resistance regarding that.
So it seems to me, and I also want you to give us a quick picture about what's happening in some of the other nations where we have heavy or large Afro-descendant populations. But I want to pose this question. Is there sort of a dual demand, and that is to say the demand on the state in Brazil that participated in one way or another or was complicitous in the slave trade, but are demands also being made on Portugal?
Portugal, I would say that is the country that is the most silent country regarding its participation in the Atlantic slave trade. However, now there is a growing number of black activists in Portugal who are demanding then this recognition, not yet financial reparations, but for example, there was a recent decision that came from these demands to build a big memorial to the Atlantic slave trade in Lisbon. I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but there is this growing awareness, and it's also motivated by the not only by the involvement of Portugal in the Atlantic slave trade, but also because of the role of Portugal in during colonialism, and especially then in Angola and in West Africa. Then these immigrants or the descendants of these old immigrants who came to Portugal as part of these movements during the period of colonialism, they are now also making these demands. Then there is a bridge built between the issue of the slave trade and colonialism, which makes Portugal a more complicated case, but a very interesting case in terms of how they deny this their responsibility in this atrocity.
Hmm. And what about quickly other, you mentioned Peru and whatnot. What about your, do you include material, sort of a survey of some of the other countries that have large Afro-descendant populations in South
Yes,
America?
Yes, you did. Most of the book is on the United States, because it's really here in the United States where there were
I understand that, but I'm just asking you, while we talked about Brazil, could you just give us a glimpse of what might be going on in countries like Peru?
Peru, not much in terms of financial demands, but for example, Colombia is another case. Ecuador, there is a small country, but these two countries, I would say either Colombia and Ecuador, had in recent constitutions that were enacted then nearly 20 years ago, that included provisions to award land to its black populations. Then these are the two countries that have similar discussions to those that we see in Brazil. I would say especially Colombia, that has a larger population of African descent, and Ecuador, that has a small population, but that is being recognized, and this issue of land is being discussed, and black movements in these countries are bringing this problem. Now, of course, Venezuela has, and other countries as well, and then if you take the Caribbean and so on, but it's still in most part of Latin America because of these long-lasting ideologies of racial democracy, mestiçagem. There was this belief, that is a wrong belief, that this country's racism was not there. Racial inequalities were very often disguised under the idea that everybody was happy and living together. Of course, that over the last 20 years, 30 years, these assumptions are being really questioned. Right. And there is much more dialogue also between the black populations in these countries and with the United States and the Caribbean as well. Right. But it's still there. There are demands. They are not so strong as we see in the United States, but there are organized groups making these requests of financial and material reparations for slavery.
Well, the reason why I wanted to get a survey of Brazil and these other countries, because there's a tremendous mm-hmm. amount of literature and volumes that have been written about reparations in the United States. So I would ask, what about your particular book? What's different? What will we learn from your book that we have not learned, for example, from Randall Robinson's The Debt or many other books on reparations that have been written?
Yes. Let me tell you, first of all, this is a book by a historian that I am, and it's a book that I really provide a narrative history of these demands, and this narrative history is grounded on primary sources on various languages, and it's the first book looking at this long history from a transnational perspective, then United States, Brazil, Cuba, the Caribbean, Colombia, Ecuador, all these countries are included. And especially Brazil, I think that is the biggest contribution, because Brazil very often is absent from this discussion. Second is a book by a historian. And my point here is not to make the argument that reparations should be awarded. This is up to the activists to take from what the book says, that the book is able to demonstrate that slave owners, they received financial compensation everywhere in the Americas during the very long gradual abolition of slavery. And then I am able to make this argument based then on these primary sources and show this history of demands of reparations as not something that just emerged like in the 1990s, but by showing that this is a long fight that has been there since the 18th century, and that since the 18th century, even here in the United States, when slavery is allegedly gradually abolished, then former masters, they got compensation. And, of course, the most important example and the most shocking example of these financial compensations provided to former masters is what happened in Haiti, where after the independence, they had to pay that incredible amount of money to France in order to have their independence recognized. Then reparations to former slaves were requested even during the period when the slaves, they were very well alive, and instead of paying those reparations to former slaves, those who got compensation were the masters. And I believe that by bringing this general picture, this narrative history, organizations, activists, students, they will be able to conduct more work on this. And at the end of the day, bring sources and bring to light how important this history is.
Now, in terms of your, I appreciate the transnational value of the book. Mm-hmm. In terms of your research just on the United States, what are some of the more startling, or let me say important, findings that you would like to share with our audience in our closing minutes?
I think that I was able to put together elements that come since the 18th century, when the first slaves individually they requested the reparations. We had cases that were not put together since then. Of course, that most demands since the early since the 18th century were individual demands. After that, we have a massive movement here that was studied already by Mary Frances Berry. But I was able to make to show how these movements they had a certain continuity over time. Then, since the 18th century up to the present, that is what you do with your institute. Then, what you do with your institution is part of a very long history that in the book I was able to put together. And to put together also by indicating that people who demanded reparations in the past, they have been, these groups were criminalized, people were sent to jail, people were accused of being communists. They were even ridiculed many times by the government and by newspapers, by the press, and so on. Then when we see some of this kind of reaction today, we are able to say, look, it was like this 200 years ago. Then it's not because today reparations is something that is controversial. It has been that way since long, and this is why you needed to keep this discussion alive.
Well, it's I'm always interested in getting new contributions to a discussion on reparations. Tell us where we can get the book.
You can get the book on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, then especially online, and some bookstores perhaps they have the book. I know that here in Washington D.C., at least at Howard University Bookstore, you get. But the cheapest way probably is to get it online. Then the book is available by Googling the title of the book. You are able to get it on Kindle, on hardback if you want to suggest for libraries, and the paperback edition is also available. Then it's easy to get the book.
So the title of the book again is Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade. Is that the complete title?
Yes, Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade, a Transnational and Comparative History.
Okay. All right. Well, we really, really appreciate you spending time with us this morning. We have a few friends at Howard University, so maybe we'll get an opportunity to meet you in the not-too-distant future since, again, we have lots of friends there at Howard University and in the greater D.C. area. So, and I know that people with the National African American Reparations Commission have taken note of your book and are reviewing it. So, again, we really, really appreciate this contribution to the discussion.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And I'd be pleased to meet you and anybody else who is interested in discussing this issue.
All right. Thank you so much. Again, the book is Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade, Dr. Anna Lucia Araujo. I hope I got that right, who is the Director of Undergraduate Programs at Howard University. We're going to take a break and come right back, and we're going to be discussing When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir with none other than our special guest, Anna Asha Bandelli. We'll be right back.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
Okay, we're back. And again, glad to lead the program with a discussion on reparations. And again, the new book is entitled Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade. And the uniqueness is to take a transnational view, which I think is most important. A lot of discussion, obviously, in the United States on reparations, but to be aware of what's going on in Brazil and going on in Colombia and Peru and other countries, I thought was an important part of that discussion as well. So again, the book is entitled Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade. Next up, we want to talk about an incredible book that is sweeping the country today. It's called When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. And to contribute to the conversation, which is an understatement, is none other than Asha Bandeli. And Asha Bandeli is with the Drug Policy Alliance, someone I've known for many, many years, and I'm delighted to have her on the program today. Asha Bandeli, welcome to Vantage Point.
You are not more delighted than I am to be here. Hi, Dr. Ron. How are you?
I'm doing good. Really, first time I've had a chance to interview you, however, and that's a real treat. So I really want to start, because again, we go way back, and there's a lot to Asha Bandeli, and I want our audience to know a bit about you, because you're an activist, but you're also someone who sort of synthesizes the creative arts and culture with your activism. So tell us a little about yourself. Are you native to New York? Did you come from somewhere else? Just give us a little bit about Asha Bandeli.
Yeah, I was born in the Bronx and raised in Manhattan, although I've been a proud Brooklynite for roughly 30 years. As a student, which is when you met me in the late 1980s, in 1989, we were protesting Mario Cuomo's expansion of the prison industrial complex, and he was sort of taking dollar for dollar the amount of money that was designated or had been designated for public higher education and putting it into building prisons. And this is a man who had already circumvented what voters had asked him not to do. Voters had said, please don't use don't float a bond that would build more prisons. And so Cuomo, in what was a truly horrific move, took money that had been set aside on the day that Martin Luther King was buried, and had been set aside for low-income housing. And he used it to begin that expansion of prisons, and then he dipped into the coffers of public higher ed. It was something that we'd see the nation follow suit in doing. California, did a very similar thing. And I just felt that it was important to do two things, right? One was stand up against anybody who is going to continue to build out the architecture of punishment, control, containment, and confinement that had been the only way that black people have ever had a consistent relationship with the United States of America and pre-colonial America. And we had to stand up. But I also knew that as somebody who was a writer, that there was a way to synthesize the arts in doing that. Not everybody was going to read a report. Not everybody was going to go to a rally. But some of us would read books, or that we'd read articles. And that's where I've tried to make a large part of my contribution, because I didn't want to be part of a movement that was essentially always looking inward and talking to the few of us who agreed with us.
Right.
I wanted to ensure that other people saw what we were saying, people of good heart and goodwill, so that we would continue to raise our voices, which to me is the most patriotic thing you can do, is challenge a government when the government is wrong.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. I laughed, chuckled a little bit when you made that last statement, because I have this phrase that we really cannot win if we continue to have an incestuous conversation with ourselves. There's some people who believe that. You know, we get together, have a rally, and it's just us, and we think we're going to win that way. Let me just ask you, though, because that was a big choice for you, because you had a whole career path with Essence Magazine and some other kinds of ways that you could have gone in terms of your artistic and cultural career, your writer and so forth. Tell us a little bit about your role with Essence and Susan Taylor and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I still work with Essence. I mean, it was really a very beautiful thing. Essence ran a portion of my second book, The Prisoner's Wife, back in 1999, and then asked me to come and work with them as an editor, which I did for a number of years. I left because I got a fellowship to do a postgraduate work at Columbia University. And, you know, and quite honestly, I was a new mother, and it allowed me the space to parent a little without doing it on roller skates, which is what I've been doing. I've been traveling all over the world and all over the country because I had two beats. One was entertainment, and one was politics. And so that meant that, you know, I was sort of between Hollywood and South Africa, you know, in different places around the world. And, you know, didn't leave the time that I wanted as a single parent. My husband, you know, was incarcerated, to just be with my daughter. And that was very important to me. And that year allowed us a very special moment in our relationship, because I'd gone back to work 3 weeks to the day she was born, back to reporting, and, you know, it was difficult. So I continued, you know, to work with Essence, although in different capacities, for many years, you know, producing Essence Music Festival, sitting at the feet of Susan Taylor. I continued to write for Essence, worked with them on their Black Lives Matter historic cover, which I was very proud of. It's the first place that ever told Patrice's story, Patrice, Alicia, and Opal's story. Let me correct myself. Because heretofore, the Black Lives Matter movement and its creation had been attributed to young men, and that was just not true, and I didn't want to see the continued erasure of women's work. And so I continue on with Essence, which is now proudly Black-owned again, come home to the community, and very excited about that. But I wanted to do more, I think, deliberate and intentional work around expanding our movement. And while I was at Columbia, I was offered the opportunity to come on as a director at the Drug Policy Alliance, which was the nation's leading organization working to end the drug war. And I knew that the drug war had been the vehicle through which we were, through which the nation, not you and me, was able to build out the prison system, even when drugs were not the instant offense someone was charged with, because it just allowed for a certain kind of militarization of our police. It allowed for the demonization of Black people at a moment when we were standing at the height of the moral mountain, and you know, the moments post the civil rights and Black power movement. You know, Nixon began the drug war and started demonizing Black people. And of course, now we know that John Ehrlichman, his top advisor, has admitted they knew that they were lying in saying that, you know, we were all these kinds of demonic people pushing drugs on kids, et cetera. But they did it anyway. And so there came through the 70s and 80s a way that we began to see Black people as nothing more than criminal. And when I say we in this, I don't only mean white people or people outside of our race. I mean, we did too. If most
right.
people, if they close their eyes and we think about a drug seller or somebody who uses drugs, it comes up as somebody who's Black. And most people who use crack are white. Most people who sell crack are white. And we don't have that. And it's, you know, I've tried to use this time to ask people to think about what it means that we contributed to the stigmatization and demonization of our people, and to do something about it. We didn't know. I don't think people did it to harm folks. I just think that we didn't know, but we know now.
Right.
And so now we have to stand up and say, 2.2 million people went missing on our watch. What are we going to do about it? Because in 100 years, they're going to look back and wonder, how in the world did the United States, with 5% of the world's population, end up being the nation with 25% of its prison population? How did that happen? How were people getting sentences for simple drug selling that were life plus 325 years? How are they putting grandmothers in prison, people who are basically sustenance sellers because there's no jobs left anywhere, which is always the reason we functioned in underground markets. It was because there were no above-ground markets for us to function in and save and secure our families. And we don't ask those questions. We don't ask those questions about what did deindustrialization do to our community, right? And it goes back to the adage that if America has a cold, black people have pneumonia, and
that's
certainly
right.
That's been true since the 70s.
Well, this new volume, which is sweeping the country, is a collaboration or a work along with Patrice Cullors. So talk us, and you already referenced it, but talk to us about your relationship with her and Black Lives Matter. How did that develop?
Patrice was actually somebody who I met doing the work at Drug Policy. She had come to one of our gatherings. We have an annual meeting of the organizations we fund each year. She came as a part of that group, and she rightfully was critical of the way in which we were running the meeting. And I was saying something, and she kind of disrupted it and said, "This isn't supposed to be the way we do this stuff." And her critiques were right, and they were heard. I heard them, and from there, I really invited her in to say more and do more. And this was back around 2010, I think. Maybe it was 2011. I don't remember now. But and we developed a friendship from there. And so when she started, along with Alicia and Opal, Black Lives Matter, I watched very closely. And then when I saw that they were not being given the credit that they were due, Essence Magazine had reached out to me to help a bit with their Black Lives Matter cover. And I said, here's how we really need to do this. And so Essence became the first place that told the story about how Black Lives Matter really started. And then sometime later, an editor had approached Patrice about writing a book, and it took her a while to grapple with that, and eventually she agreed that she did have a story she wanted to tell, and she asked me if I would work with her on that. And so, you know, I'm a reporter as much as I am an author and a fiction writer and everything else, and I've certainly written memoir. And so over a course of a series of interviews and listening to her story, we ended up with a book in sort of record time, about 5 weeks, and
wow.
We're grateful. And it was funny when I got the proofs back or the manuscript back from our editor with almost no edits to it. I was terrified. I thought, did she read it? I'm used to having whole things handed back to me, whole books handed back to me.
Right.
And my agent said to me, Victoria Sanders, the best agent in the business, said to me, let me let you in on a secret. And I said, okay, what is it? And I thought she'd tell me, you know, they just want to get the book out or something. And she goes, you know, you wrote a great book. Leave it alone. And we're really grateful for the reviews and the attention that it's getting. And it just really shows, I think, what we're capable of doing in a short period of time, if you put your whole heart and soul into it, if you really lean in, we can produce excellence and we can shift hearts and minds, which is what this book hopes to do. Patrice's story puts a painfully human face on the cost of this nation's decision to have a drug war and to mass incarcerate and to have a war on gangs, which comes out of the drug war. And to essentially decide that an entire generation, likely two generations, were expendable.
So tell us about the book. You're already beginning to do that, and I had hoped to have Patrice on, but we just couldn't work it out because she's in Atlanta, because this book is like a conflagration. It's a positive, sweeping all over the country, getting rave reviews. I mean, it's just busting out all over the place, so I couldn't get her on. But, you know, I said since I couldn't get her on, I would at least start with you. So give us a sense of the narrative of the book and some of the things that are revealed that our audience would want to know about as we encourage them, obviously, to purchase it.
Thank you so much. And, yeah, just naming that, yeah, the book tour is brutal. I did the first week of it, and then I had too many things I had to do back home. And so just sending love out to Patrice, who is really out there grinding from, you know, it starts at 4 in the morning often and doesn't end until 11 at night. And so she's speaking to people all over the nation for the balance of this week, and it'll continue on like that for quite some time. But the story really tells about what it meant to live at the epicenter of the drug war in Southern California, about a young woman who was poor, whose family was written off, a mother who worked three jobs to make ends meet, a father who was dislocated from his work and you know, couldn't bring in any money, and her discovery that she had another father, the father who raised Patrice, was not her birth father. Her birth father had been incarcerated for a drug conviction, and she loves both of those men very, very deeply and feels nurtured, and that both of those men live in her soul. And so it looks at what was done to a generation, in particular at first, of black men who were thrown away, the impact that that had on the family, what secondary trauma looks like. And it also looks at her brother, who suffers from schizoaffective disorder, and the ways in which he was treated. You know, he really had a dual diagnosis of that and of any drug use that he was really using to self-medicate, because there was no architecture available for him to be assessed and treated and cared for. The first time he's diagnosed is when he's incarcerated, and he's incarcerated because he's mentally ill, not because he ever harmed anyone. And we should know that there are more people sitting in prisons and jails in the U.S. who have significant mental illness than there are in all the psychiatric hospitals combined. We incarcerate trauma. We incarcerate mental health issues. We incarcerate pain. We don't treat it. And so Patrice looks at all of that, and what it really does so beautifully, and what her Swire story is so important, is that it's a true coming of age. There's no reason that we should know who she is, right? If the United States had it their way, this little black girl from a poor family would have been written off. She would have been written off because she was poor, because she was black, because she was queer. For any number of reasons, she would have been written off. And like her father, Gabriel, she kept coming back. She kept coming back to the work and dedicating herself to wanting to make a world that was safe for all of our children, for all of our people, for all in our community. Patrice has been an organizer since she was 16 years old. Black Lives Matter didn't just happen. It wasn't just the turn up. She's been a trained organizer and public speaker and out there in the world working often for no pay, which I didn't know, for years and years and years. And so the Black Lives Matter movement is an outgrowth of this dedication that she's had since she was a child herself, and a child who had been in many ways dislocated by a society that has little room for black, queer, poor girls.
Wow. This book is one that is a must read. I mean, and I guess there's so many lessons, and you've sort of talked about them, which is why I think the book is important, because I think we're at a critical stage in the dialogue. And you mentioned something earlier when you talked about the war on drugs and how people were stigmatizing people, what the images were and so forth. And you referenced the reality of it wasn't just white people. It was really about us. And you were very kind, and I think correctly so, because some of this wasn't malevolently or mean-spirited. It was just confronting something and maybe not knowing how to grapple with it and the complexities of it and the existential reality of just wanting to be safe, either perceived or in reality. But we're moving towards a different place. And I wish you'd speak to that in terms of the critical importance of particularly black people to have a different perspective on all of these issues as we sort of, in many respects, heal ourselves and really sort of build out towards a more just and humane and safe society.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Dr. Ron, when you're black in America, you're already born with a certain kind of stigma, right? We're already considered less capable, lazy, whatever the stereotypes are. I lived in foster care as a child, but I was adopted by a family when I was almost three, who my parents, and you know, afforded me a great deal of privilege. And even still, you know, the kinds of battles that I have to wage in order to be seen as somebody who is strategic and thoughtful and can manage, those are not usually ascribed to me. I think what's usually ascribed, again, to black people, no matter our station in life, is that we can speak well, we do the turn-up, but we're not that we actually think through and have a plan. And so I think that, you know, I say that to say that living with all of that stigma, what white supremacy, you know, to name it for exactly what it is, did is say, well, I might be a nigga, but I ain't that one. And that's what it does. It separates us. And it's in some way to get to whatever we think is a place where we'll be loved, where we'll be honored, where we'll be treated with dignity and respect. And so when white people determined that here were a group of black people that you shouldn't treat with dignity and respect, some of us went along with that, including me, unwittingly. And we didn't look at the other things that impacted why our communities were harmed. So no one ever talked about that there was more crack and cocaine being done in the 1980s by white people. But what was the difference? Why didn't their communities fall apart? Their communities didn't fall apart because they had employee assistance programs, because there were other structures in place to ensure that their lives mattered. And so the Black Lives Matter movement intersects beautifully with the drug policy reform movement because it says our lives have value, each one of them. And that is at the core of the work that we do in drug policy reform, the ethos that every life has value. And so to the extent that we're trying to break down those barriers and say if they put one of us on the trains, they're going to put all of us on the trains, and either we respect us all or we respect none, is monumentally important. And it's a hard thing to grapple with because there is, and we acknowledge, there's been real harm that's been done, you know, within our communities, right? But what is the response to that? And is it a response that actually says that no more harm will ever be done again? And so part of what we do in this work is look at a transformative sense of justice, right? It's something that we can actually live and breathe and be free in the kind of world that we want our children to grow in. So, you know, that's really been the issue. I think that, you know, what we were sold was a lie. We were sold the idea that if you just get rid of these people from the community, you're going to be all right. But as I sit here today, they put in all of those people in prison, and 45.6% of our babies still wake up in abject poverty. Because they swept away our incomes, not just parents, not just brothers and sisters and cousins and aunties and uncles. They swept away incomes and tax bases and everything else. And so we have all these children who are born already shackled because they don't even have, maybe their mother didn't have proper prenatal care, they may not have proper food. We certainly know in Flint they don't even have proper water, and that Flint is not the only city that's like that. And so until we as a community collectively say that all of our lives matter, every black life matters, that we're not going to get where we need to go. And we hope that this book is part of what will be a narrative shift about who we are, about our dignity, about what we deserve. That's what we're really trying to do, is to shift a narrative, right, and to not see one black person as good and one black person is bad. We didn't used to do that. As I remind people that when we were coming up and I was a little girl in the 1970s and 80s, you know, people didn't think of drug sellers initially as the enemy. They didn't. They were part of our community. And, you know, and often people will tell you the stories about people who were working in the underground economy in whatever position, whether it was number running or whatever it was. And those were often the men who would say, you better get yourself to school.
That's right. That's right.
And then, and we forget that this is who they were. These were not demons. These were not people coming after our children. They were people. They were fathers. In many cases, they were role models, right? Even if they told you, don't do my profession. Go to school. I didn't have a shot. Right.
Absolutely.
So we forget all that. And this is our effort to begin to reclaim some piece of that truth, some piece of that history of us that's been written off and written out.
Well, it's a powerful, powerful book, and I know there. Tell us how the people can get the book. I know they're the usual places, but I want to say that because this is an opportunity to tell people to go get it. So, how do people get the book?
You know, the book is available everywhere and certainly available online. We always ask people to please try to buy from a New York Times reporting store, whether that's in Esalen Books in L.A., a Black-owned bookstore, or Barnes & Noble that has done so much to elevate and put this book forward. It was one of their big picks, you know, what we're reading now, and they've done a lot to support us, or Amazon.com that named us the number one in biographies and memoirs for African Americans. We've really been supported, and so we're just really asking people to go out and buy the book because, you know, it's important to say, Dr. Ron, that if we don't show up for us, there won't be more books like this.
That's right.
You know,
absolutely.
And since me and Patrice, our contract is done, and in a certain way our work is done, but we want 1,000 flowers to bloom. There's, right, 8 million stories in the Naked City, and we want all of those stories told. We don't want publishers to think that this is a fluke, that this is one book they have to publish and they can go back to only publishing vampire stories or whatever the case may be, or give us books that are only about unrealistic visions of romance, which is often what they'll publish for black people. Publishing doesn't have a lot of black editors. We were fortunate to be among the best team in publishing, led by a black woman named Monique Patterson. But there are not that many black senior editors, not that many people who are immediately and intuitively going to get our stories. And if we want our stories out there, then we've got to show up. And now that just becomes a, you know, a commerce question. And so the more books we move, the more books they'll buy like this, the more books they'll get out there like this, and the more of our truth will be told and will disrupt the narrative that's currently out there still and being pushed out by, you know, everyone from the White House, everyone in the White House, to other, even network news organizations that have moved ever more rightward. And remembering that we have less media now than we did in 1970, Dr.
Absolutely.
Ron, that's a very
Absolutely.
Important thing for people to forget. Facebook and Twitter does not make up for having actual books and films and stage plays and what have you. It's these things that will stand the test of time. And if we want to have more of them, then we've got to show up when we see something that really tells the truth about who we are and is of value to our lives.
Asha, I know you have to run, and finally, if people want to do like meet and greets, or even without either of you, but just want to purchase the book and have different events and that kind of thing, or is there a mechanism for doing that? Is there a number through Black Lives Matter or something that people can call to get some guidance about those things?
Yes, anybody can email me at my office address. It's abandele@drugpolicy.org. Let me spell that. ABANDELE @drugpolicy.org, and I'll ensure that those requests are put to the proper team, so you're not just going through a publicist. You'll have me to respond. If I don't respond immediately, just email me again and say, where you at, lady? Because we certainly want to be in the community and with our people. We're organizers, and so this book should be thought of as a tool.
Well, Asha Bandele, thank you so much for spending time. You have so much to say, so much to do, and I know I got this note from you. Dr. Ron, let me out at 11 o'clock because I got to keep fighting. I got more stuff to do, so I'm not going to stand in your way. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ron. I'll see you soon.
All right. Okay, that was Asha Bandele, and really wanted to get some to her background and who she is. She is amazing. She's incredible. And I think one of the things that I've found, a friend of mine Greg Achille said this once, and I think it's, I found this to be true in my own work over the years, that we have to appeal to people's hearts and not just their minds. In other words, we don't just need to make the intellectual argument. We need to speak to people in a way that touches them. And you hear, and the way she talks, you hear that. You hear that desire. That's what the narrative is about, putting a face on what it means to be poor, to be black, to be queer, and the afflictions that go on with that. These are not statistics. These are not numbers. These are our people. And one of the most important contributions made by Black Lives Matter was that point. Not only were the three founders black women, I think two of the three are also the LGBTQ community. But they wanted to be sure that Black Lives Matter means all black lives, everybody. And to be able to confront and deal with trans people, lesbian and gay people, and queer people as a part of that proposition who are black, to bring them out of the closet, so to speak, and to let them openly contribute their brilliance. Patrice Cullors is a brilliant, brilliant person, organizer, and not in the closet anymore. That's a good thing. Not only for black people, it's also a good thing for humanity. It's a good thing for this country. It's a good thing, you know, for the world. So we thank Asha Bandela for coming on with us. The book, again, is called When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter Memoir. And again, Asha really, you know, put her own number out there. If you want to contact her, arrange a meet and greet, a book party, a, you know, an event where you can discuss the book and so forth, is A. Bandela at drugpolicyalliance.org. We'll take a break and come back, and I'm going up on the soapbox to talk about Negroes who harm black people. We'll be right back after this break.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
There was a song came on the radio, a guitar instrumental, and it changed everything.
Link Wray, it's rock and roll.
Rumble. Yeah, that's the one.
Rumble.
Hey, Rumble.
Rumble had the power to help me say, I'm going to be a musician.
And then I found out that he was an Indian.
The music that we know here in the United States is fully supported by input from Native and Indigenous people.
Sayago, this is John Cain from WBAI's Let's Talk. Join me on January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, as we kick off 2018 with a free screening of Rumble, the Indians who rocked the world.
Yeah, now we're into the final hour of Vantage Point. Ooh, I'm enjoying this. Again, the book, two books today. The first book, Reparations for Slavery and the Slave Trade, which really these books sort of in some ways relate to each other, because we've always been, since our enforced captivity, been marginalized, stigmatized, demonized, disrespected, disregarded, all those things. And there is a concerted movement in this country and throughout the world. The reparations movement has never been more powerful than it is today. And again, the whole question of Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter movement, by the way, also raising the issue of reparations and reparatory justice. Drug Policy Alliance also taking up that call in terms of its work, particularly the reparatory justice aspects of it, that the war on drugs must be, we must have compensation, we must have repair from all the damages done from the war on drugs. So this is these are some nice convergences that are taking place. So the book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir, and again, it's all over the place, but they were saying, particularly by way of the New York Times affiliated stores, simply because that helps to boost sales, and there's a whole marketing thing here. So Barnes and Noble's, I think, was identified and others. And if you really want to do an event, and I'm hoping we can do something with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and in the interest of disclosure, we are a partner with the Drug Policy Alliance, and delighted and proud to be so. Perhaps we'll be able to do something in a not-too-distant future here in New York and bring Patrice in and do a forum and a book signing or something along those lines, something we're certainly willing to consider. Well, I now want to spend some time, because I'm a little upset, to put it mildly, with Negroes who harm the race. You know, we don't use that term Negro anymore. I was trained by Queen Mother Moore. And Queen Mother Moore said, you know, let's get rid of this term Negro. It is a demeaning term, she said. You know, Black people, we began in this country, and then when I had the privilege and honor of speaking at the Corona and East Elmhurst Clergy Association's annual Martin Luther King Day program, you know, I talked about the fact that when I was much younger in the city of Youngstown, Ohio, I was a member of Tabernacle Baptist Church, but we would often have a second church, and that second church, I forget the name of the church now, but it was an AME Zion church. And we would walk by that church on the way to Tabernacle, because in those days we did a lot of walking. We didn't ride as much as we do today. And I was absolutely amazed that it took forever. I was well into my adulthood, influenced by the Black Power, Black Consciousness movement, to know what the AME meant. Because we were colored, we were Negroes. I mean, we were really not Black people. We didn't want anything to do with Black. And we certainly didn't want to be African. So we were Negroes. That's why we have, and I'm not saying this in a disparaging way, we still have the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Well, the AME is African Methodist Episcopal. Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, when they created the first Black denomination, it was the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. The first Baptist churches were African Baptist churches. Somehow along the way, we morphed into this colored thing, and then we went into this Negro thing. And to some degree, it was because, I guess, of conflicted feelings about who we were and our identity and all of that kind of stuff, and certainly an aversion for Blackness, particularly in a society where white is always right. And certainly when we got, many in our generation, raised on Jungle Jim and Tarzan and all that stuff, nobody wanted to be Black and nobody wanted to be African. Well, of course, that changed. And Queen Mother Moore was instrumental in doing that. Queen Mother Audley Moore, one of the most fierce, intellectual, dynamic, visionary women warriors of our time. And she was one of the persons who operated on my constipated mind, because she said she was a brain surgeon. Her task was to operate on constipated minds, and mine was one of them. She said, I'd rather be a Negro than a Negro, because she said, going back to the Latin, the Portuguese, or whatever, she said, the N, ni, that prefix in front of anything is negative. You know, never, nefarious, negate, any of those kind of terms. In front of the Black, the Negroes, so no, never shall you go Black. So, but I'd rather be a Negro, because when you do rehabilitate, reestablish, revitalize, re-envision, the re is growing, it's expanding. But anyway, the whole thing about that is to say, get rid of that Negro stuff. We're black people. But more than that, she said, we're not only black, we're African. She was on the forefront of teaching us that people of African descent are African and that we should be proud of that. So this Negro term sort of then fall out of fashion, and it really became more now a disparaging term. So I want to be a bit disparaging today, talking about Negroes. Now, there was an article recently a lot of discussion recently about New York City Council and the fact that we've never had a black person, a African person, person of African descent, male or female, be the council speaker or president of council. And people were lamenting the fact that in the middle of all this, the fact that we have majority black people and brown people, and some of those brown people are also black people in terms of their descent, their lineage, by the way, that we somehow can't have a speaker. Well, I got news for you. We might have a speaker if the black people could get together with the brown people, but let's just stick with the black people for a minute and say, rather than have the phenomenon of the pop-up Negro, every Negro popping up to say, I want to be speaker, I want to be speaker, I want to be speaker, five or six Negroes popping up to say, I want to be speaker, maybe we could have gotten together and decided that there would be one person who would be the primary candidate, no matter who that person will be, so that therefore there could be no divide and conquer on the plantation. Because here in New York, that's what it is. It is a political plantation where these bosses, and sometimes these bosses have black faces, at least that used to be the case in Brooklyn. I guess that's no longer the case now. But it's a plantation system. And so they decide and cut deals between the Bronx machine or the organization and the Queens machine, and they decide whether it'll be somebody from the Bronx, somebody from the Queens, or whether it'll be somebody from Manhattan. So in this instance, despite the fact that we have mostly black council persons and Latino council persons and some Asian, South Pacific Islander council persons, they are the majority, as Councilman Charles Barron or Assemblyman Charles Barron often points out and has done for years. And, of course, his wife Inez, who symbolically entered the race at the end as a councilwoman, they've always pointed out there's no reason why we should not have had a black person be speaker. Now, to be fair, some progress was made because the last speaker was a Latina. That represents progress. But black folks, we can't complain if we can't get our act together and we're all competing with each other rather than sitting down and saying, as happened one time, and even then it was difficult, because I recall many years ago, even when Councilman Charles Barron was on the council, that he supported, I think it was Councilman Leroy Comrie. So let's all rally around Councilman Leroy Comrie, because he was trying to say, it's impossible if we're going to have a series of Negroes who will put their own individual aspirations, as good as they may be, to be the speaker above a process who would determine who might best be the person to be the speaker. Now, they may all be qualified, but you can't all run at once. That's like political organizing 101. Can't do it. To function otherwise is to speak to a phenomenon in our community, a malady that we don't have sufficient political process in order to deal with these kinds of matters. So it contributes to the phenomenon of the pop-up Negro. Every Negro, or many of them, pop up and want to be speaker. Nobody can work together to decide which one should be the one. And then we lament afterwards, well, we didn't get selected, and they left us out. Well, yeah, they left you out, because you don't use elementary, basic political organizing skill and intelligence, which makes you a Negro. I love you, though. This is the kind part. I like all of the persons who were running. They're all good people. But the lesson to be learned is that we must have political process in our community. And this is not just a New York phenomenon. And by the way, let me just say, a few years ago, the same thing happened. We almost missed Yvette Clark being congressperson because we had several Negroes aspiring for the position. And then we had collaborators with the Negroes, enabling them and encouraging them, because we had major political leaders, some of which I couldn't mention, who said, I'll support this one. And another major political leader says, I'll support that one. And another leader said, I'll support that one. Instead of these major political leaders getting together and saying, whoa, we want to make sure we have the seat. We're not entitled to it. It's not a black seat. You know, I mean, anybody can run for the seat. I heard that was the same discussion. Well, you know, that person shouldn't run because this is the black seat. Well, you can't stop white people from running for political office, or Asians, or anybody else. They have a right to run. If you're not intelligent enough to get yourself organized in such a way to win the seat, then somebody white might win the seat. And so what? This is a democracy. They have a right to do so. But fortunately, in that particular situation, Yvette Clark prevailed. Let's go to Atlanta for a minute. Just barely lucked out in Atlanta. I was watching from afar. I don't know how many Negroes was running for mayor of Atlanta. And this was not just people who were here, were people in Atlanta who were gave up major political positions to run for mayor. I don't know what, is there some special largesse in the mayor's office? What's going on here? What's so prestigious about being mayor? In fact, if you're mapping black political power, you would do that by saying we need black people who are conscious, socially and politically conscious, and that's important, who are in strategic positions to help deliver not to black people, but to all people, particularly those who are oppressed and poor and marginalized. That's who we are. So this ain't just a black thing in that sense. It is about, yes, making sure the black community is empowered, but our empowerment would always lead to our healing, but the healing of all oppressed groups. That's who we are. That's where we've been. So let's be clear about that. But in Atlanta, I don't know how many it was. It may have been, I may be exaggerating, it may have been 14 candidates running in the primary. And in a city where you don't have a supermajority anymore like you had, like 70%. Now it's maybe 55%, somewhere like that. Just barely eked it out by maybe 500, maybe less than 1,000 votes, when that was not necessary if people got together through a process and said, rather than 14 run, here are the three best candidates. And, you know, then, you know, there will be some other candidates who run, non-black candidates who run, so forth and so on. Higher probability in that scenario that, well, really it's better to just have one. But if you can't have one, say to the community, these are the top three. But then you have like 14. And some of them have, you know, no other aspirations than their aspirations. That's what makes it Negro-like. We don't need that. We need political process. Memphis, Tennessee, another example. When Harold Ford decided, and I didn't think that was a politically smart move, he somehow was delusional enough to think that in red Tennessee, that if he went far enough to the right and made himself conservative enough and acceptable enough to white people, they would elect him senator. Or maybe it was governor, one of the two. Probably it was one of the two. Maybe governor, maybe senator from Tennessee, right? Now, that happens, by the way, because there have been Bobby Jindal, who's elected in Louisiana, and Nikki Haley's been elected in South Carolina. But what you miss is, in the overall scheme of things, as Dr. Waldo Stewart has taught us, this society has decided that we're going to have some people that we will bestow quietly, but maybe not so quietly, honorary white status on. And frankly, there are people from the Indian community have been granted. That's a group. Now, I'm not making this as an anti-Indian statement. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that within the broader scheme of this white supremacist, right-wing onslaught that we're facing, they've made the decision that there are certain folk that they would rather bring in through immigration and certain people that they would like to anoint internally that they're willing to support. Now, it is true that you could be so innocuous and so non-black that you could get elected, like Tim Scott in South Carolina also got elected. Nobody even know, half the people didn't know he was black, because he's been elected primarily by maybe some black people vote for him just because he's black. But really, he was anointed by white people, and he was sufficiently safe, non-threatening, and conservative that they were able to put him in. But these are the exceptions, not the rule. Anyway, so Harold Ford decided to run. He lost, of course. But his congressional seat, you know, the same thing happened. Whole bunch of folks decided they wanted to take his position. Bunch of them. Everybody popped up, pop-up Negroes running all over the place, decided to run for a seat. And they lost. And as a result, we now have a white congressman who replaced him. I'm blanking on his name. He happens to be good, by the way. And by the way, one of the things that happens is that black people are more generous and kind, frankly, than some white people are in this regard. We will vote for white people, particularly if those white people will do the job. And in some instances, we even give them the benefit of the doubt beyond that. But this particular councilman in Memphis, whose name I'm blanking on, happens to be good. He's progressive. He stands with the Congressional Black Caucus on most of his issues. He supports reparations. He signed on to H.R. 40. So he's good. But it could have been a disaster, because you could have selected somebody who wasn't so good, simply because black people could not get together and decide on a single candidate. Now, this person has been reelected, and I don't have any problem with that, because it's really not just about skin color. It's about your politics. It's about your ideology and your ability to serve your constituencies. So this particular congressman, and his name will come to me. I have great respect for him, actually. May come to me in a minute, and I'll say his name. So I'm concerned about the lack of political process in the black community, where we have what I call the phenomenon of the pop-up Negro harming our potential aspirations in terms of political power being exercised effectively, which means, and I say that because you have people who are, if you are just promoting yourself, even if you're a good councilman, the idea that you can't collaborate with others to come up with a decision about who the one person should be, and that then blocks the ability of someone to have that position, means you have not sufficiently purged from your system that Negroness that needs to go. I say that lovingly. I do not say Negro lovingly of these collaborators. This is a guy named Denard. I wrote his name down. He's always on NBC and CNN and so forth and so on. If Donald Trump got up and called black people the N-word, he would find a way to explain. Well, he used the N-word because he was trying to say something about, and he was trying to understand it. You don't really understand what his narrative is. He really cares about black people, and there's more jobs being created. They would find a way to rationalize the most absurd, racist. I mean, there is no way to rationalize the S-hole comment. None. In fact, it should be replayed right now. And this debate about what's going on around the closing the shutting down the government and immigration policy, that should be in his face constantly. The most vicious, brutal, vile, but overt. And then trying to go around and try to say, how's this playing? That was the first. And then there was a firestorm of criticism. But that criticism has subsided now, because it's back to dealing with this madman as usual. But what is utterly maddening and unforgivable are the collaborators who are around him. I'm not interested in diversity in the Clinton in this administration. Diversity about what? There's nothing to diversify. This man is an outright, well, even if he isn't a white outright racist, he is acting like one. And he's doing it deliberately, which means that he is a racist. But you have these Negroes who at the White House, and you'll even find some, you know, who are, they're the degrees, you know what I mean? There's some who are 100% Negro, and some may be 85% Negro, and so forth. Some are even associated with the King family. They will dig up somewhere in the King family tree somebody who is a third or fourth or fifth cousin or nephew and trot that Negro out to try to give some legitimacy to that which is not legitimate and cannot be legitimized. Negroes, collaborators, there's always been that. In the Nazi concentration camp, there were Jews who collaborated with the Nazis. These are the most vile. These are the most despicable people who will sell their own people out and provide cover for the oppression of black people and for marginalized people. This is not acceptable. So these collaborators need to be excommunicated from the race. They are pariahs who should be banished from the race. We need to eradicate Trumpism, not legitimize it in any way. And it's like Malcolm said, these are real house Negroes. My earlier commentator, I was being a little hyperbole, just trying to, I'm making a point, but these Negroes are like Malcolm's proverbial house Negroes.
What's the matter, boss? You said asshole? Well, we understand that we are asshole. And boss, we wish you'd say a little different, but we understand what you're saying. And by the way, I say to the black community, where can we find a better articulator of our positions than boss man, orange man? I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, these people are unbelievable. We need to eradicate Trumpism, and we need to get rid of these Negroes who are harming the race. Give us a call at 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. I'm on the soapbox today. Y'all might get mad at me. They may even chase me off the air. But I just had to get that out of my system because I see what's happening with Negroes who are harming the race. And I think it's something that we need to address and deal with. And at the end of the day, how we address it and how we deal with it is through resistance. Resistance in the streets. Resistance in terms of civil disobedience, economic boycotts, and yes, marching on ballot boxes with a vengeance. One of the things that just recently, and we'll have more to say about this next week, there is, and the Haitian community was certainly in the streets big time, I guess it was last Friday, big time in the streets. The continental African community, supported by African Americans and others, it looks like another major demonstration coming up. Well, one of the things that I found most interesting in the conversation with some folks that we were meeting with last Friday was that people are now talking about how to take power, how to engage. Some brothers and sisters up in the Bronx from the continental African community saying, look, we can't be on the margins anymore. We just can't be immigrants who are outside the par process. You know, we have to engage both in terms of electoral politics, get rid of some of these people who are not being responsive. We have to march. We have to demonstrate. We have to be engaged. But we also have to march on ballot boxes. And we think this is a good thing, a good development that has to be made. We have to find new leadership. That doesn't necessarily mean young. Young, yes, but new leadership that is not contaminated by Negroitis. That's what we need to do. Give us a call. Join in the conversation at 347-335-0818. We're going to take a brief pause here. Come back and take your calls the rest of the way here on Vantage Point. 347-335-0818. Right back after this break.
When black people like me talk to the slaves, they didn't kill them. They send some old house Negro along behind him to undo what he said. You have to read the history of slavery to understand this. There were two kinds of Negroes. There was that old house Negro and the field Negro. And the house Negro always looked out for his master. When the field Negroes got too much out of line, he held them back in check. He put them back on the plantation. The house Negro could afford to do that because he lived better than the field Negro. He ate better, he dressed better, and he lived in a better house. He lived right up next to his master in the attic or the basement. He ate the same food his master ate and wore his same clothes. And he could talk just like his master. Good diction. And he loved his master more than his master loved himself. That's why he didn't want his master hurt. If the master got sick, he'd say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick?" When the master's house caught a fire, he'd try and put the fire out. He didn't want his master's house burned. He never wanted his master's property threatened. And he was more defensive of it than the master was. That was the house Negro. But then you had some field Negroes who lived in huts, had nothing to lose. They wore the worst kind of clothes. They ate the worst food. And they caught hell. They felt the sting of the lash. They hated their master. Oh, yes, they did. If the master got sick, they prayed that the master died. If the master's house caught a fire, they prayed for a strong wind to come along. This was the difference between the two. And today you still have house Negroes and field Negroes.
Okay, we're back, and we want to open it up to our audience. Now, I'm going to tell you how in sync Michael G. Haskins, our chief announcer, is with why I praise him so. Now, I'm busy doing a whole bunch of things, right? Now, I meant to send him a note saying, "Michael, can we plug that piece in by Malcolm?" I didn't send him the note, but he plugged it in anyway. Man, we be vibing together on this thing, I tell you. 347-335-0818. Let's go to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Greetings to the beloved family. Ron, this is the problem about this discussion about how Negroes harm us. You yourself are a textbook example of what you seem to be decrying. As you wound down your career with the Center for Constitutional Rights, we scratched our heads because there was no help for the Central Park Five, the people dealing with foster care guardianships. And when you were approached by a sister in terms of a collaboration, which you claim not to remember, however, that's not the case, because when you decided to take the sister's intellectual information, use the same words and call it your own, and also co-opt a name and deceive elders for the other part of the name, and at the same time, in that moment, you let the sister know exactly what your intention would be. So you, as a sister, we want to have the sister sit for a polygraph, but I'm sure you won't feel comfortable with that, because of the fact that when you decided to take something and call it your own and didn't even hear the larger ideas,
excuse
it would
me,
save lives, black lives.
Hold on a minute.
You decided to let the sister know that is, there's nothing more deceptive than that, and you will be exposed. That's all I have to say.
I don't have this lady has this long standing grievance that I have polygraph, no graph, whatever, bring it on. I don't have no idea what she's talking about. At the Center for Constitutional Rights, we had an intake process. Any case that had to be reviewed and so forth was not my own personal decision. We had a process by which we decided which cases to take and not the case. We certainly were very much concerned about the Central Park Five. They had their own legal team, as I recall it, in recollection. I do know that I personally developed a relationship with the mother of one of the Central Park Five and so forth. So I have no idea what she's talking about, but that's okay. This is an ancient grievance that she raises over and over and over again, but that's okay. Let's go to our next caller, 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, okay, morning. I'm coming out calling from Brooklyn. In terms of your discourse about the house Negroes, they're going to be exposed, trust me. The people have to be really educated. You'd be surprised. People don't work with the people in the community like they should. They only call on them when they need something, then cast them aside. But I want to make a point. Brother Automatics Jr., he did a lot. He did a lot for Al Sharpton. He did a lot for the Central Park Joggers.
Hello? Are you still there? I don't know. We seem to have lost her. Okay, others can call. I don't know what happened to that call. She was talking about our attorney at war, Alton Maddox, when we lost her. Let's pick up the next call, 347-335-0818. And remember now the two points I was trying to make, two circumstances. One, we need to find processes in the political arena to find out who are our best candidates. And in a situation where there can be divide and exploit, that's particularly true. If we're in an all-black or majority black city council, ward, or wherever, we got 70% of the people or whatever, you know, then if you know, black people run against each other, it's not a problem. But if you're in a situation where you have 50-50 or maybe 55 black, 45 white and other, and you really want to hang on to that seat, and by the way, when I say hang on to that seat, I mean with a progressive black person, because frankly, a progressive white person would be better than a reactionary black person. Let me be clear about that. I mean, I would want one of these people that are around Trump to be elected. That would be disastrous. That's the difference between Clarence Thomas and Thurgood Marshall. Both black, but they're not the same. Clarence Thomas and Thurgood Marshall are miles apart in terms of their ideological political positions. So I don't want more Clarence Thomases, right? I'd rather have a progressive Latino, Asian, or white person rather than a Clarence Thomas. I want to be clear about that. But if we want to have a progressive black person maintain a particular seat, then we have to have a process by which we sit down with each other with structures and say, wait a minute, now we know we can't all run together. We can't, all y'all can't run. If you all run, we're not going to make it. So let's decide, let's put aspirations aside, put the community first, and decide which of you is the best candidate and can has the best capacity to win this seat, and we'll support you. That's the kind of political process that I'm talking about in terms of this particular discussion. So, and that's the spirit in which I used this term Negro. I was using it not so much to be harsh with these brothers and sisters, many of whom are well-meaning, but our well-meaningness is getting obscured and is blocking our ability to be effective if we cannot translate that into collaborating and coming up with ways and means of, you know, making good decisions politically. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hey, how you doing, brother?
Good.
Hey, my name is Africa. I'm calling from Newark. I'm a sociologist by trade, and what you're saying is organizing. Basically, institutions have to be in place that organize people that think the way you're talking about. As black people, we don't think monolithically. The politicians, they don't go in there trying to do, like, save black people. They go in there trying to find a job, trying to take care of their families, trying to do their own selfish needs. We have not produced a people that think monolithically and understand the vision that our people are going in. So this conversation is just like going around in circles. They're never really dealing with the concrete things that oppress our people. Like, I live in North New Jersey. Our mayor is Roz Baraka. His father was Mary Baraka. So that means that's like over 30, 40, 50, 60 years of organizing to get this person into that position to be a mayor. Right now, starting February 1st, we get local control of our schools back, which we haven't had in over 20 some odd years. You would think the people in this community would be trying to prop them up, trying to make sure we build institutions to keep the legacy going. But that is not what you hear in the community. It's people fighting, just like you're saying in New York, trying to jockey for positions to get political positions, and they're throwing out all kind of allegations. And I'm just watching, and I'm saying to myself, like, when is somebody going to get it that we need to build these institutions to produce these people? And, like, a platform like WBAI, I believe that's what this institution should be doing. It should be that kind of institution for the people. That's why the people never hold power. The people win all the battles. They use the people to win every single battle in our society. they lie to us, get us to walk one way, to go to one side. But at the end, we benefit nothing. I'm poor. I have 3 degrees, and I live in a project in North New Jersey. Like, well, part of it is kind of my doing because I work in this community. I have a nonprofit, and I work here. But there's other people here with degrees. There's other people that's living here that's going through this same circumstances and realities I'm going through. And there are no institutions to help these people or to guide our people to where we need to go. It is all anybody just come up with your own idea. Whatever facts you have, you run with it, and you just try to justify it. It don't matter if you lie. It don't matter what you do. Just try to justify it. And we have no institution to produce people that think the way we want them to think. And that is the problem.
Well, so brother, it's like, yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. And I think that, you know, we will never all be, you know, monolithic, everybody on the same page. That's not likely
I'm
to
still
happen.
On? I'm still on?
Yeah, but let me just finish my thought.
No. Before I go up. No, if we build schools, if we teach our own children who our heroes are. No, that's how you groom. I told you I'm a sociologist. If you bring up children in that manner, they will not value materialism. They will not value socioeconomics over humanity. So until we do that, we're not going to save ourselves. We're going to be educated by the state that produces workers for the state. Right. I just wanted to get that in.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Appreciate your call. I actually agree with that, and I think there are people in Newark, there are different coalitions, organizations like POP, and there's another organization dealing with the issue of violence in the community. I forget that coalition now. I don't know, maybe the anti-violence, whatever it is. There are groups working together. Now, I think those groups sometimes need to work closer together and collaborate a little bit more as well. But there are some good signs in Newark in terms of people on the ground. So, yeah, there are some reactionary forces who are trying to malign and trying to discredit Mayor Roz Baraka. But there are, I think, far more forces on the ground who support him, who are strong, and who really want to see his vision succeed. And count me as one of them. We're looking to do some things that we'll talk about. In fact, we're going to be asking WBAI to be supportive of. Coming up in April, coming out of the State of the Black World Conference. We went to Newark for a reason. We went to Newark because we wanted to support the long struggle of progressive, you know, black people in that city to try to come up with a vision that's different than just, you know, again, folks just wanting to be in office for the sake of being in office. And I think that we have to help build that infrastructure with Mayor Roz Baraka because he can't do it by himself. And there are people working with him, but we have to figure out how to help him because he's moving some really powerful things forward. He's talked about a jobs program to employ X numbers of people by 2020. He's, you know, talking about, you know, helping to build up the neighborhoods. But that ain't easy work. And there's some people, the people are tugging at them. There are people who are trying, who don't like that vision. They will smile in his face, meaning from the political establishment, smile in his face, and then try to find some black people to cut his throat. There's no question about that. So we have to find ways to buttress them. And we in the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, in a nonpartisan way, because we're not political, we're not a political organization in that sense, but through programs, we hope to try to support the whole basic movement to have Newark be a city that's a model city, you know, in terms of participation of people and engagement. And you'll be hearing more about that as we move forward. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to say, in terms of the city council, which you brought up, and I think it's an excellent example, and it's across the board in terms of politics or anything else, the people can get together who are there, the elected officials who are already there, who are black, and cast votes amongst themselves and knock each other out amongst themselves and come up with one or, like you said, maybe three, and then present themselves. Something else, in terms of Haiti and the long-standing existing problems in Haiti and the machinations that were going on, and the theft and injustice and things like that, and an organization such as yours, did you see what was happening? Did your organization see what was happening, call them out before they were called out on such mass levels? And I'm still wondering, are you still a Clinton supporter? Another thing, in terms of Mugabe, are you still anti-Mugabe? And in terms of another thing, in terms of HIV and AIDS. Where are you now? Before, you were very much along with the system in terms of HIV and AIDS.
When you say and HIV,
let me finish, please. Just one more thing, please.
Okay, go ahead.
In terms of coupling HIV and AIDS with the recognized, accepted third leading cause of death in America, which is medical error inside the institutions, not people who leave the institutions and die because of improper procedures from medications or operations and things like that, but actually inside these things. And when we looked at when the whole nation catches a cold, we catch pneumonia.
Right.
Where are you in terms of HIV and AIDS? I remember before you accepted everything completely, and you were very disparaging about those who said that HIV and AIDS, something was extremely wrong there.
I don't understand.
Well, go ahead.
Hold on. Let's just deal with these one things at a time. Let's deal with this latest one. I don't know where you're coming from about this whole issue of HIV AIDS. I've never really said much on the record about that, except to say...
You said so to me on WBAI, called you in at the late night when you had that night flight, I think it was, and you were very disparaging. And
disparaging in what way? Disparaging
you were saying that HIV and AIDS, HIV was actually documented. It was what it was. It was a virus. It was causing all these maladies. The medication, you said, was not the problem. It was HIV and AIDS, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, you know, I'd have to go back and reflect on that. But suffice it to say that one of the things I'm delighted about is that at least we took the stigma off of it, because inside the African-American community, you know, people were not willing to address the HIV.
But there's nothing to AIDS. Take the stigma off.
Will you let me finish now?
Okay, go ahead.
In the black community, because of homophobia, people were seeing it as a homosexual disease and therefore did not want to deal with it. I think it's fair to say that was one of the things that was happening. We've gotten over that, and thank you. We've had organizations, particularly faith-based organizations, get into the leadership of moving forward to try to address the issue, because HIV/AIDS is a major problem that has to be addressed, that has to be dealt with. Now, there were some people who were denying that it was... Even leaders in South Africa denied that it existed, that it was real, and that we should have to address it. Now, I'm not one of those. If you're saying that I was one of those people, then you're incorrect, because I never denied that HIV/AIDS is an issue. It needs to be addressed. Now, some people were trying to debate where it came from and this and what how it should be treated and all that. That's a whole nother controversy. But suffice it to say, we need to address the issue of HIV/AIDS. I'm glad that progress is being made, though we still are the ones who suffer most from that. Let me just quickly tick off these other three things for you, because I don't really back up from my positions. Number one, I've never been anti-Mugabe. At the very beginning, we supported Mugabe. My history goes back to into the 70s in terms of relationships with people, with the ZANU and the Patriotic Front. What I don't support is presidents for life, particularly in a situation where, and this is documented, the kind of tactics that are used to cling to power in a way that it seemed to me that eventually became the case. I'm hoping that there'll be a new breath of life that's taking place in Zimbabwe now. So I don't apologize for that, and we could have a long debate about that. I believed that in terms of Libya, the AU's position should have been respected. They should have mediated that conflict such that the United States of America should not have invaded, should not have been involved in the destruction of the regime of Muammar Gaddafi. Where we part ways is I do not share some people's glorification of Gaddafi as the greatest Pan-Africanist of all time, because in my position at the Center for Constitutional Rights, I know that he was complicitous in terms of rendering people, the United States government sending people to Libya to be tortured. I don't support that. I know that Gaddafi was involved with the Janjaweed and helping to destabilize the Darfur. So there are some things about Gaddafi that I did not support. Finally, I never, ever have been great friends of the Clintons, except to say in a choice between what we have now and what the Clintons, what Hillary Clinton would have brought to the table, she was clearly the better choice. Yes, I still stand for that position. Let's go to our next caller. You're on Vantage Point. Do we have another caller?
Not yet. We're waiting.
Okay. All right. Well, that was a long call there. So we can take maybe one more call, 347-335-0818. We're really trying to address the issue specifically of how our disunity led to not being able to select a black person for the city council, and situations where we're potentially losing political power because we have too many people scrambling for positions, and we allow perhaps the non-black person to be elected because we don't have political process. And the other issue we were talking about, that these people who surround the orange man in the White House, these apologists, these collaborators, you know, and who, if he said, you know, this is like Malcolm said, you bark when the white man says bark, you know, what's the matter, boss? We sick. I mean, that's what we were really examining and talking about. And some people were actually addressing that as well. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hi, good morning. First, I just want to make a comment. That's it. But I want to say you're a brave man. You're a brave man. That's my comment. I want to say that the difference, in my opinion, between Parrish Denard and Omarosa is a difference. It's subtle, but it is a difference. I believe Parrish Denard is a collaborator and Omarosa is cooperator. She's very into it for herself, and when she got the boot, for whatever reason, she's going to do a tell-all book, or maybe she'll take conversations to whoever listened to her. Whereas Parrish Denard, he's in it like blood. He's a collaborator. Somewhere in his mind, it's like what you was quoting with Malcolm X. We sick. I don't believe he really felt that whatever he was alleged to have said about African countries, I don't believe he felt that he should have said it different. He made all kind of excuses. It's very clear because he's a collaborator. He really sees, in my opinion, that Trump's success is his success, and they're together. But he don't see that he's being used because he's always put out in front of black people to speak so he can prove that Trump is not racist because, after all, Paris is black. How could he be racist? So that's why I say there's a distinction. I believe Omarosa, she's in it for herself, and if it's not worth her time, she gets out. And now she says, I was trying to help my people. Right. And there's some things that made me uncomfortable. She actually admitted, but after she got out. But there are some things I've heard that made me very uncomfortable. Parrish Denard will never admit that. He will say, well, I wouldn't have said that. Or are you sure that's what he said? He made all kind of excuses.
Yeah, he really did.
The two of them, if you had to speak to the two of them, you'll see the difference. One is a cooperator, because when it's in for her, she's down. When it's not in for her, she's out. And one is a collaborator. He's in it to the end because he believes he's going to get something out of it.
Right.
That's what I think is the difference between those two. And neither one of them are good. However, if we want to save what we have, it's like a matrix. One is going to stay in, and one may come out.
Right. All right. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your call. I don't know if we can squeeze one more in or not. 347-335-0818. Can we get one more call in before we have to make our exit? Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Okay. Well, I guess we didn't get one more call before we exited the stage. But in any event, good discussion. And I always like to keep the microphones open, and we take whatever callers have to bring it. We'll deal with it as best we can. And yes, I take positions that are not necessarily consistent with some of my revolutionary friends. And I see myself as a revolutionary, make no mistake about it. But I also think that we have to have revolutionary ethics, revolutionary morals, revolutionary consistency in terms of human rights and values that deal with democracy and those kinds of things. And that often sets me up as a target because, you know, I'm just not down with anybody on the basis of the means justifies the end. And we do a lot of that discussion. We have a organization called Pan-African Unity Dialogue in which we debate these issues. And particularly in terms of the crisis points in Africa, trying to look for some new paradigms of leadership on the African continent that will be much more consistent with what it is that was envisioned in terms of the original anti-colonial struggles. What has happened is that just like in this country, we have people who've gotten into office who've lost the original vision. They're now more concerned with their own self-aggrandizement, and in some instances will do almost anything to maintain power while continuing to sell us the rhetoric of black power, the rhetoric of economic development, the rhetoric when really it's me, my cronies, my friends, and the masses of the people still suffering. That is not acceptable, you know, at this stage of the revolutionary process in the 21st century. Anyway, enjoyed the show. Next week, we'll be coming back with another exciting show. Got some real surprises for next week. Please visit the website ibw21.org to see what we're doing with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, including a lot of work on reparations. And don't forget to become a WBAI buddy to sustain WBAI and to keep these kinds of conversations alive. Keep the faith. We'll see you again here next week on Vantage Point.
Hi, this is
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts. Our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
There was a song came on the radio, a guitar instrumental, and it changed everything.
Link Ray, it's rock and roll.
Rumble. Yeah, that's the one.
Rumble.
Hey, Rumble.
Rumble had the power to help me say, I'm going to be a musician.
And then I found out that he was an Indian.
The music that we know here in the United States is fully supported by input from Native and Indigenous people.
Sayago, this is John Cain from WBAI's Let's Talk. Join me on January 31st at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, as we kick off 2018 with a free screening of Rumble, the Indians who rocked the world.
Make Ifa, make Ifa, make Ifa. Ifa, Ifa, in sanctified chalk of my silver-painted soot,